Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com. Welcome to Midnight in Karachi. I'm Mavish Marad. My guest today is Megan Abbott, a writer who has been called the Queen of Noir. Megan's seven novels include the most recently published The Fever, and before that Dare Me, which was chosen by Entertainment Weekly and Amazon as one of the best books of 2012. She's written for numerous publications and she's been nominated for multiple awards, including three Edgar Awards, the Hammett Prize and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. The Fever was one of my favorite books last year, and it's a complex, devious mix of a narrative. It's clever and it's lean and it's effective. I admit I may have a bit of a writer crush on Megan Abbott, so I'm thrilled to have her on the show. Megan, welcome to Midnight in Karachi, and thank you so much for being here.
Oh, I'm so delighted to be.
Now, I couldn't decide where to start this conversation because I had so many things I wanted to talk to you about. So I thought, why not start at the beginning? This whole writing business, this whole writing fiction business, how did that come about? Was Megan Abbott, the child or the teenager, always going to be a writer when she grew up?
No, not at all. I really fell into it. I always was a book lover and a compulsive reader, and my father's a writer and my mom writes now, but it just seemed to, because I loved books so much, it seemed too, I don't know, grandiose or a thing to dream for. It seemed impossible. So I never really thought it would happen, and I kind of slowly backed into it just by writing a lot, I guess. Getting lucky early on, in terms of publishing, that I was able to stay in the game.
Were you always going to, when you did start writing, did you always think it was going to be noir and thrillers?
No, that really came, really, again, so much of my career has been accidental. I planned to be a professor of literature, and I was getting my PhD, and I wrote my graduate thesis on hard-boiled fiction and film noir. And so I just read, for a couple years, just that's all I read. And that's when I started writing my first book. So it came out of wanting to kind of burrow my way into those books that I loved so much. And when I wrote my first one, I didn't even really know if it was a crime novel, because to me it was a psychological, and it was about mood and atmosphere of noir. So I didn't really know what it was. I just knew that I wanted to be in that dark world.
So it's almost as if you started writing fan fiction.
Yes.
In a way.
Gosh, yes. No one's ever put it that way, but it's really true. Not so much with character, but with setting for sure, and with mood and everything else, everything but the characters.
I think a lot of writers start out that way because there's something you love that you want to be able to create, and it's a great way to start.
Yes, I think so too. I think that's probably the best way, because you're coming from a place of love rather than bestsellerdom or trying to figure out what the people want.
Absolutely.
It should be pure, right?
Yeah. Now, as you were saying, you wanted to be a professor, you wanted to teach, and you do that. And you've studied hard-boiled fiction, you've studied noir, and you've written nonfiction about aspects of it as well. You have I think it was a version of your dissertation that was your first book. Your first published book was nonfiction. Did knowing something so well end up, as we were talking about fan fiction just now, did it ever influence your own writer's voice? Did you have to kind of struggle away from saying, no, that sounds too much like Hammett, or that sounds too much like somebody else?
Yeah, it was never, I think it would be a far bigger problem if I were writing more exclusively in the world of men. But there's so few female characters that are given full expression in noir, which is not a criticism of noir. It's just a fact, of classic noir. So there's just so little about the female experience from the inside that it was easier for that reason to offer a fresh perspective, I think.
And how fantastic is it that you did that? Because, fine, you're not criticizing noir. I'll criticize noir because it really does. I mean, the women really are just very, very you know, it's that whole gangster mall kind of thing. It's just a very one-dimensional character most of the time. Not to say I don't love some of the women in, or I do, in the films and in the hardboiled fiction as well. But I think it's great that you did what you did for women in this genre.
Yeah, it's been wonderful to be a part of a sort of movement in that area, and there is much to enjoy about classic noir female characters. That femme fatale is not really a person, which is its limit, but she is quite powerful. So I think that's still a great inspiration. The sort of the power of the female is really, in some ways, what noir is about. So it's kind of great now for a lot of writers who are getting to sort of speak about the female experience of that world.
Now, from Die a Little to The End of Everything, Dare Me, and now The Fever, to me, your exploration of teen girls is so much scarier than your stories about grown women handling actual danger. What brought about this shift, this change of pace from sort of, I guess, if I can say pure noir, even though you were writing from a female perspective, to something... To these clever thrillers that focused on younger women? Was there, you know, on your part, was there an active choice in moving away from noir?
Yeah, there was, and only in that, you know, and I still imagine myself writing, you know, something in the classic noir vein again, but there, after writing four in a row, I did feel like I wasn't challenging myself. You know, it was so easy and intoxicating to write in that world, but it wasn't sort of pushing me into uncomfortable places as a writer. That sounds kind of, I don't know, a little obnoxious, but it really was true. It really felt like this is, you know, and it also, I was avoiding writing about the world I live in. And it seems like at some point every writer should try to do that. So that was certainly why bringing it contemporary and, you know, what we would call here suburban, you know, in terms of the age of the girls, I just kind of fell into that. And then it felt like this sort of rich pot of jewels because I just remember how complicated that age was and how much aggression and desire and weird feelings I felt then. And so there's still just not that much that's written seriously about girls that age. So again, it felt like this stuff where it was just not as well-trod territory. So why not?
Yeah. And it's funny, as you say, that you fell into this writing about young girls or teenage girls, but you've written more about teenage girls, I suppose, in a way, as you've moved further away from being a teenager. Did that kind of distance kind of offer better understanding? I wonder, because, you know, I have a daughter now and I was a teenager a very long time ago, and I still think I don't really understand what it's like to be a teen girl, having been one, because each person's experience is so unique.
Yes, and I think part of this writing about it is trying to figure it out, sort of crack the code. I mean, it's for women especially, I think that age is so fundamentally important, and the choices we make there affect us for so long. And it's the age at which you kind of break out from peer culture and become yourself. So I think, you know, writing about it is a way of trying to learn something about it. And also, I think it's the last time before everything gets really mediated and complicated and ambiguous and ambivalent. So it's really interesting to keep going back there to that place when everything feels extreme and certain and awful and beautiful, you know,
right,
before you realize that life is not those extremes, you know. So I think that there's a lot of room to play and to be scared. For teenagers now, though, do have you know, pressures that certainly I didn't have as a teenager, and I'm guessing you didn't either because of social media and a lot of the stuff in the last 10 years even. And that, imagining what that would be like has been really interesting for me.
Now, I have to know, and even though you've just, you know, The Fever isn't so old yet, I still have it in hardback, it's still a new book, but I have to know, please tell me this writing about teen girls is not a phase. I mean, it isn't like Picasso's blue period, right? From 50 years from now, we'll say, oh yes, Megan's teen girl phase. Does it feel like that while you're in it?
You know, it's because I hear, you know, it's so weird. The more books you put out, the more people want you to do the book that was like this book, or to never stop doing this, or to stop doing this and doing this. But in the end, you just follow what, you know, unless you're a very calculating person, probably in a better way than I am, you don't really think that way. You just, the story, it goes from character and story, and the rest kind of happens. So my next book is from the point of view of a mother of a teenage girl. So it's still in that world, but I guess a different corner on it. And as long as I can keep finding corners, I'll probably hover in this territory for a while.
Yeah. I'm happy with whatever you write. I was just asking, you know, for everybody else, for a friend.
Yeah.
But I have to know how much of the girls that you create, the girls you do create, and I know I'm focusing on this because The Fever was the most recent novel, but their dynamics, these young women, their dynamics, their relationships, their histories, how much of that is real, as it were? Because there's obviously a lot of research involved in all your novels, whether it's about cheerleaders or whether it's, you know, about this mysterious illness in a small town that's affecting the young women. So there's obviously a certain amount of research, but at which point do you just start making things up, as it were?
Yeah, it is a mix. It's hard. I really like research, so I tend to pick subjects that permit me to do a lot of it. But then you kind of have to let it go, or it doesn't become a book. It becomes a report or something, you know, a sociological study. So I try to let it go pretty early on, and then only return to it as needed, and instead let the characters, you know, it's far more about getting acquainted with the characters, and
right.
and they continue to surprise me sometimes to the very end of the book, and that's one of the great gifts of writing and reading. So you want to then kind of have the reader have that same experience.
I love when a writer says that, because as somebody who doesn't write fiction, I've never completely understood this. And to me, it's like magic that this character surprises you, a character that you've written. But it's obviously because it's coming from some subconscious part of your mind, you know?
Yes.
But it's interesting, because then I wonder how many of these characters you write come to you whole. How many of them develop, as it were, while you're writing? I mean, is it a constant evolution? Are there any who appear to you completely and you say, this is it, this is how they're going to stay?
Very rarely. I often think I know them, you know, that well, it's happened on a few occasions. But it's almost something I distrust. Are they really fully developed or rich characters, or are they types? Are they, you know, I would be distrustful of the feeling that they had come out full born, you know, that I would be sort of wary of. It seems like they've got to kind of shift under the sentences as you go through the book, because they get thrown in these situations, and they have, I just always believe in my favorite kind of books, you know, every character in the book, even the darkest ones, they all have his or her own reasons for why they do what they do, and that I don't usually know until I'm there. So you know, I don't like really kind of villains, you know, so even the ones that would be considered villains, when I start the book, I hope that I can find their humanity, or where the damage lies, and, you know, and the hurt, you know, that kind of stuff.
One of the many things that I really appreciated about The Fever was your ability to voice and create unique voices for so many characters. It wasn't just, say, Deanie or Lise or, you know, any of the young women. It was also Deanie's brother. It was also her father. It was also the mothers of some of her friends. Getting inside the head of, or getting inside the heads, rather, of so many diverse characters. How do you go about that? If it's a question about process, almost.
Yeah, no, it is, and it was a real change for me, because my books tend to be somewhat insular, and often first person, and often really tight. And this was my attempt to do a larger landscape, and it felt really important to me, especially to have the father and the brother in there, because it's a super feminine world in some ways, the world of the book, because this malady is affecting only females, and I just come off writing Dare Me, which is, you know, all, practically all female world. So it was, it felt really like it was necessary and would be invigorating to have some of the male experience and to write a little bit about male wonder and confusion about the mysteries of women, you know. Right. So that felt like important to round it out, and then to give, you know, these sort of like suburban moms, these sort of middle class, you know, moms who you know, aren't considered glamorous or interesting people by the larger culture here. I wanted to give them a complicated histories of, you know, desire and regret too.
Now, you were mentioning Deremy. I know you've written a screenplay for it. How was that experience translating, almost like a translation, a narrative that you've created into another form for someone else to create into yet another form?
Yeah, that was very challenging because in the end, it's not even a translation exactly. You hope you keep the essence the same, but it's such a different way of telling a story, and it's so, you know, I always compare it, you know, a novel is sort of like an ocean beach, and a screenplay is like a thimble full of sand, you know. You have very little room. You have to rely on different techniques to you know, you don't go into characters' heads. You have to rely on, but it still has to come alive on the page. You can't just count on actors or directors. So you really think about action differently and spectacle and taking advantage of the visual. And so I had to really, yeah, it was a whole different language for me. It was really exciting ultimately, but at the beginning it just felt impossible. You know, I just kept trying to drop scenes from the book, and it just doesn't work that way. You know, it's like trying to, I don't know, mate a sheep with a parrot or something, you know. It just doesn't work. So you have to become the parrot, you know.
Did it make you nervous?
Strange analogy.
No. But yet it makes sense. Did it make you nervous waiting to see how someone else recreates on the screen the images that were, you know, only in your head for a while? I mean, I'd be petrified.
Yeah, no, it is, especially because, you know, when you enter the Hollywood, you know, Hollywood has very specific ideas of how teen girls should be represented, what teenage girls would want to see, you know, and they're, you know, and they don't always jibe with my sense of it, you know, but in the end, you're really working for them, you know, when you're hired to do the screenplay as well, and you have to just kind of trust the people you're working with, and then kind of just release it, because, you know, no one wants to hear from the writer once they've turned the script in, you know, it's sort of out of your hands, so in some way, that's a relief, because you can't exert any influence, you have to sort of just let go and say, this isn't yours anymore. This is going to be a different thing.
And do we know when that film is going to happen?
No, it's, you know, 9 out of 10, well, probably 9.9 movies out of 10 don't actually get made. I'm hopeful it's in development. There's also been interest in moving it to TV, which would be great. That's where, here at least, that's where a lot of the great storytelling is
happening.
That
would be
now.
Fantastic. So, yeah, TV, no, TV's picked up all over the world. That would be really amazing if it did happen.
Yeah, I'm really hopeful. It feels like maybe a more natural fit to novel. Novels, you know, in terms of the storytelling, you
right.
know, a little leisure with it. But there's still a lot of interest in it. So I'm hopeful that one or the other of those will move forward.
All right. Now, I have to ask about Lois Duncan. And I have to ask about Virginia Andrews, both writers that I read as, a preteen in late 80s Karachi. Sneaking in Andrews, of course, when I wasn't supposed to be, because my parents came across this and said, what is this incestuous rubbish? Throw it out. Well, you know, it's a weird story because some family friend, I don't even know where they got these books from. At that point in Karachi, you didn't have great bookstores that stocked things like The Fever. You had to go to your secondhand markets and your secondhand bookstores and pick up what the hippie trail had left behind in the 70s that had filtered down. And so, you know, somebody brought a bunch of these books to my home, my parents' home, and they sat on a table in the foyer of our house for a long time because my parents kept forgetting to pick them up on their way out. And in the morning, we had a carpool with a neighbor a couple of streets away. And in the morning, I'd be ready and I'd be waiting, you know, for this friend to pick me up for school. And I would sneak pages of this book. I would stand in because I would get ready earlier And I would just be like, oh, I'm just going to go wait for her at the door. And I would sneakily read. So I read Flowers in the Attic standing in a... And I remember very well it was winter. And I remember standing in the cold foyer waiting for this person to pick me up and thinking, please be late, please be late, so I could sneak more of this book in. And it's very strange because, I mean, it destroyed me, you know? It destroyed me in so many ways. And yet... it was just something I had never... I mean, I must have been 10, so, you know, maybe I should have read it later. I don't know. But I was obsessed with this series for a while. It was strange, strange, complicated books, right?
I agree, absolutely. I had a very... It's uncannily similar experience to you in that, my parents would have let me read them, but they wouldn't have liked it. They believe in... You know, they're literary folk. So I never had them in my house. And my best friend, older sisters, had them in her house. And I remember they would be on the stairwell landing upstairs. And they would be sitting there with the great keyhole covers. I don't know if you're
those are exactly the ones I had.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And you open it and you're like, wow. Because it's
exactly. Yeah. So I remember
it's
reading
so
it
80s at the same
there.
Time. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I think it's the Forbidden Box. You know, is it so much about dark female sexuality in
Absolutely.
A way that really, really has never been replicated before since. You know, I in that raw and unmediated form, and part of the sort of somewhat sloppy and repetitive prose, all the things that sort of make it not a good book, are actually the things that make it purer in some way. You feel like you've gotten access to the real thing because it hasn't been smoothed out at all. You know, it hasn't been polished. It mm-hmm. hasn't been made pretty or so it feels almost like uncovering someone else's middle of the night dream that also you realize is your own.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a dirty secret that you shared with someone else that you didn't know you shared.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But both these women, both Virginia Andrews and Lois Duncan, who I also read, but that was not, I mean, not sneakily, because that wasn't so obviously bad for you. And they both, as you said, wrote about female friendships. They wrote about teen sexual awakening. They wrote about losing the illusions you have about being adults, about being, you know, about what adulthood will be like when you get to that age, that kind of crux of, you know, turning over into being an adult and you suddenly realize it's not what you thought it was going to be. It's something that you write about as well. It's powerful and a strange time for girls and like we were saying, very unique in a way for each. But also, as you and I just discovered in our reading of the Virginia Andrew books, that there's obviously certain things that are shared similarly across cultures and times.
Yes.
Did both of these writers sort of, you know, did they influence your writing in a way? Did you take something away from them or choose to take something from them?
Definitely. I remember reading all of those Lois Duncan books and they're far less explicit or and weird than Andrews, but they really are about, you know, the horror and suspense in them in some ways is a metaphor for the horror and suspense of female adolescence, I think. It's almost like smuggling. These books get away with a lot because they look like simple thrillers or trashy novels, but I think they have these sort of resonant truths about being a girl. And the kind of, the terror at that age, every day is a disillusionment. All your fantasies of adulthood are proven to be false, that you're lied to constantly. The adult world looks dark and frightening and strange, and you know what it is. And it's not just what's out there, it's what's in your own home. And that's, you know, it's sort of like just the sort of stuff every adolescent girl goes through, but it's writ large, which is exactly what you want at that age. You want it writ large because it feels large. I reread a few of the first, the ones that she definitively wrote, the first about four years ago, and they held up astoundingly well.
Really?
They were really upsetting in the same ways. And then, you know, they have this double layer of uncomfortableness now because they're uncomfortable in the ways that they should be uncomfortable. And then they're uncomfortable because you remember or you have a sense or you don't have a sense of yourself reading it before. You know, so you're thinking of yourself at age 11, 12, 13, or however old you were. And what the heck, you know, so you're sort of reading yourself in some way at that age, which is really a weird feeling, but a productive one in some ways, because it is like telescoping back to that age and trying to figure out what it was that you saw in it then. And did you see this? And did you really get this? And did you know what this meant? Did you know that this was really icky? You know, that kind of stuff.
Right. I think we knew it was icky.
Yeah. Certainly if we were hiding it, you know, or
absolutely
furtively reading it.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned how it's upsetting and worrying. And can I please tell you what is really upsetting and worrying? Did you see the recent TV movie, Made of Flowers in the Attic?
Yes.
Now that was upsetting. Heather Graham, could Heather Graham never act?
Oh, she's just popped her eyes the whole time.
I know. It was amazing. I watched it with this horrific, I mean, again, it was that car crash scenario feeling all over again. And part of me, and, you know, obviously when you've read the books, you keep thinking, okay, fine, there wasn't like immense depth all the time, but there was more than this.
Yes. No, and it was, I was so hopeful because the preview for it was very stylish and I thought maybe this is going to be it, but it was, you cannot cram that epic novel into, you know, an hour and 40 minutes. And they just, it was so campy. And of course the book is the opposite of campy. It's so pure. You know, I almost think that David Lynch is the only director who should ever really have his hands on it.
That's very true, actually.
You know, because he believes deeply in melodrama, in the gothic, and he never makes fun of it. And this felt like he was making fun of the book and by extension the readers, you know?
I don't mind campy sometimes, but you're right, this just didn't work. It was a bad camp. It wasn't the good, fun kind of camp. Yeah, because you could have that as well.
Right.
I mean, American Horror Story, I think, does camp really well nowadays, but this was not.
Yes. No, and these books are, you know, I think they fall apart. They're so naturally, they're so have the elements that are open to camp that it you can't do it as camp, you know.
Right.
It falls apart. You know, it only works if you believe in it somehow. The response, how many people watched it was thrilling to me. It just showed me what I always believed, which is how important that these books are to generations of female readers.
You mentioned David Lynch just now saying he was possibly the right person to do something like this. Sometimes I think he'd be the right person to handle your stories as well. Would it be like a dream having him do, you know, one of your earlier noir novels?
Oh, it would be, or any of them. He's a great uncover. Of course, Blue Velvet, I remember seeing when in the 80s, when I lived in a suburb, much like the suburb of the movie. And Twin Peaks, you know, it probably has influenced me more than any object of art that I can think of. So, yeah, you know, there's just something about... and it's not the obvious things with him, you know, oh, they're weird, they're dark, you know, they're very emotional, you know, and they're, I think they're really far more inspired by the great melodramatic elements of noir, and that I really love, and I love how that has never, you know, it remains sort of the you know, he's probably the most influential filmmaker of his generation, just not in terms of the success of his movies, he's done these big blockbusters, but I think his artistic influence just is across all genres.
This is where I admit I've never seen Twin Peaks.
Oh, you have such a great gift waiting for
you.
Do
I? Should I still watch at this age, at this time in my life? Can I still watch them?
Definitely. At any age, no.
They hold up, do they? All the episodes?
They do. They really, absolutely. You will be transfixed. Before they do the return, you should try to go through the...
This is exactly... Yeah, this is why it came up, because everybody started talking about the return and I was just silent the entire... You know, Twitter went crazy. And all these writers I admire, yourself included, were all like, woohoo, Twin Peaks, David Lynch is the great. And I was just quiet thinking, oh no, I've never seen any of I think I've seen, there was like a short movie, right? Fire Walk With Me or something like that?
Yes, I might have seen that,
but I never, I mean, this is just something that never crossed my path. By the time I was old enough to go out there and get it myself or not living in Pakistan, I was at university and I could have gotten a hold of it it had kind of, you know, that big hurrah had kind of died down by that time.
Right.
So when I was very young, when it came out and I could never, I mean, living in Karachi, I couldn't have got a hold of it anyway. Or maybe I would have. I just didn't know about it. Now I think you're right. Maybe it's time to catch up.
Yes. No, based on the books that you like and your interests, I would say it's made for you. I think you'll really love it. And there's so many great classic noir elements that are woven in that I think you'll appreciate and love. But it's also just it's just beautiful and haunting, and you know, it's I wish I could watch it again for the first time. So I envy you the virginal experience of it. And it's funny because it's hard to imagine that being on network television now.
Right.
This is so frightening. There's a lot of lightness and humor to it too, but it's the most frightening thing I've ever seen too. There are scenes in it that are burned in my brain. So it was probably good that you didn't see it at that age. It would have been like another Flowers of the Attic experience.
Yeah, know? But I'm in a way I'm glad I didn't skip the Flowers in the Attic experience. It translated all the way through to, you know, curfew-led Karachi in the 80s. Now, I believe, as you mentioned earlier, your new book, it's out, well, in 2015, which would be this year by the time the podcast airs. Can you tell us anything about it? You told us a little bit before. Can you tell us more?
Yes, it's called You Will Know Me, and it's sort of about from the point of view of a mother, and it's about being the parent of a child prodigy, in this case an athletic prodigy, and the weirdness of families that revolve around a very special child and sort of hurl and hoist all their energies and hopes onto that child, and then something bad happens. So that's the sort of short version of it. And yes, it's from the point of view of the mother, and it's a teenage girl prodigy. So it was fun to work on.
That is exciting. When is it out? Do we have a month for it?
I think it's going to be early 2016, actually. Ah. Probably February, I'm thinking.
No pressure.
No.
Yeah. All right, I have a couple of other questions, just a couple more. This may not seem related, but it is. What do you think of Taylor Swift?
Oh, well, that's a great question. I think about that a lot. I have a complicated set of feelings. My basic feeling is I like her. I like her feminism. However sort of pop it might be. And I like her energy. I like her. I like what she represents in many ways. Her music, I wish I liked more, but I think it will get there for me. But I think she's an important figure, and this most recent video where she plays she plays up the sort of stereotypes.
Right.
You know, I think she's really good at that, about women scorned and the crazy woman, and you know, that's such a big discussion in the culture now. And I like how she gets right in there and makes things visible that might not be visible to her fans otherwise. So what do you think of her?
You know what? I actually decided today that Shake It Off is a really good, solid pop song.
It is, for sure.
You know what it is? I mean, I actually had to hear the entire album for work, of course. And she has a sense of agency, I think, which makes her attractive perhaps to teenagers all over the world.
Yes, and I think someone whose music I like much more, but Beyoncé, say, but she, I think she feels very remote to the average young woman. Yeah, but I think there's an accessibility to Taylor Swift that makes that agency more powerful, you know, than Beyoncé's. And I think that's great, you know.
Yeah.
I think there's a kind of awkwardness to Taylor Swift.
Absolutely.
That also, you know, there's sort of, she's the, she looks really kind of perfect, but there's a kind of geekiness to her.
Yeah, she's a bit of a goofball, right? Like, you see her, they show shots of her watching, say, the Grammys or something else, and she's acting like any little fangirl, like she's shouting and screaming and pulling her hair and making funny faces.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's also a kind of, there's a relatability. But now that you mentioned Beyoncé, there's this whole conversation about Beyoncé and, you know, feminism is what she's doing, really. I mean, feminism, again, you know, when someone says to you, are you a feminist? My answer always is, tell me what you think feminism means, because it's so different and unique to so many people. Where does Beyoncé stand in this for you?
Yes, I mean, she's fascinating to me, and I find her a sort of powerful, iconic presence.
Right.
I just think there's a, you know, she's a complicated in a way that Taylor Swift is not, though, which I actually like. I mean, there's this remoteness to her. there's sort of a mystery about her. There's sort of conspiracy theories here about her, you know, her marriage and her, you know, and her sister and all this stuff. And I think that that's a great mystique because it's a mystique that's for women. It's not necessarily for men, you know. It sort of shows that women are complicated and twisty and have, you know, different feelings on different days and can be all these different things. And I think it gives a sort of range of possibility, which just didn't seem to exist for teenage girls, say, looking for models in the pop industry even a decade ago.
Absolutely. And you're right. Beyoncé is just does come across immediately as a much more powerful, she comes across as a woman. Taylor Swift still comes across as a girl. Do you know what I mean? And
yes.
not to say that being a girl is negative, but Taylor Swift obviously still has some growing to do. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, right, right.
I think she might be here to stay, though.
I think so. I think we're going to see that growth step by step. Yeah.
But tell me, what sort of music do you listen to? And do you listen to music when you write?
Yes, I listen to all kinds of music. Generally not when I'm writing, but while I'm writing a novel, I'll have when I'm not actually physically writing, I'll have music that I associate with a certain book, almost like a playlist. I can't listen to anything with lyrics while I'm writing. So, but I will have a sort of set of songs that I begin to associate with the book in question, that I'll sort of, you know, like for Dare Me, it was a lot of really sort of Kesha and then Beyonce and a lot of kind of, you know, raucous girl music. So I'll have those that sort of inspire me. And then for the Fever, more sort of darker, stranger, more indie music that sort of fit the creepy tone I was going for. So yeah, it is really important to me.
Now, one last question. Again, it may not seem like it relates, but I swear it does. Will you ever write about Jessica Rabbit?
Oh, gosh. What is interesting.
I'm fascinated by this idea of you writing about Jessica Rabbit. I've been thinking about it for months.
I need to think about it. I have not thought about her in a long time. I mean, she came up a bit when I was doing my graduate work because, at that time it was, it was sort of whenever I would, do any research into femme fatale, of course she would come up as a sort of, this sort of cartoon send-up of the femme fatale. So I've always been very interested in her, but I'd never thought to write about it. I'll have to think about it.
No, I mean, I'd love to know, what's her story?
Yeah, right, exactly. What's the backstory? Of course, there's probably copyright issues. But,
probably, but you know.
Yeah. Now I'm going to start thinking about it. You're going to be inspiring me. I may rent that this week.
I haven't seen it in a long time, but I listen to that song that she does, Why Don't You Do Right, quite often. There's like 1,700 versions of it, but Sinead O'Connor does a really good version, and so does Katie Lang.
There's a kind of swagger to that song that I love.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's been fantastic.
Oh, this has been wonderful. Great fun. Thank you.
And I hope we will speak again when the next book is out.
Me too. I would love it.
Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Murad on Torah.com.